Welcome back to this Tuesday's episode of Across the Movie Aisle. I'm your host, Sonny Bunch. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg and Peter Suderman. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I am spiffy.
I am so happy to be talking about movies with friends.
Thanks to everybody who is listening on Tuesday for helping to keep this thing afloat. As a reminder, if you are a paying member, you get access to an extra bonus episode every week. You get our fun message board here on Substack. You get the ability to yell at me personally in the comments. And you get a new monthly-ish TV episode this July. In the upcoming month of July, we're going to be doing Spider-Noir, which is on Prime Video now. So watch it before you listen. Go watch that now. It's I don't know if Peter and Alyssa have watched it, but I've seen all eight episodes, and it's interesting. It's if you like noir and you like Spider-Man, it's Spider-Noir. And now on to controversies and non-troversies, where we find A24 getting in bed with Google to see how AI can help speed up / cheapen the filmmaking process. Ben Fritz had the exclusive at The Wall Street Journal, where he reported that Google was investing $75 million in the pseudo-indie responsible for one of the year's biggest hits, Backrooms, and Oscar monster Everything Everywhere All at Once, amongst other films. A24's Scott Belsky insisted that this is not tied to generative AI, right? Which is the sort of AI where you type, make Batman fight Charlie Brown into your plagiarism box, and it spits out crappy video of the two fighting. He said that Google would not have access to A24's data, which includes its film and television library. Rather, this is going to be used to speed up various pre-production and post-production functions. We think there are better uses that preserve creative control and support risk-taking, this A24 exec said. Basically speaking, what we're talking about here is increased help with things like storyboarding, right? Which is the process of making a shot-by-shot guide to how the film will look. It helps you plan setups, maybe spot some problems before the filming begins. I'm sure the carve-out on data has to do with contracts and the such, right? Like, I bet Robert Pattinson's contract for the drama doesn't allow for his, you know, character to be sucked up by AI and used to make future sequels to the drama, though I'm not even sure what that would look like, but you know, I don't know. Or at least there would be some sort of fight over it. The actors who work with the studios, I'm sure, probably would not like it. A24 is undoubtedly looking at some of their bigger upcoming bets, like, for instance, the insanely budgeted $175 million Elden Ring movie that Alex Garland is making for them, and thinking that they, A, need to raise more money to protect their $3.4 billion valuation, and B, need to pay for things like $175 million Elden Ring movies. I don't know what anybody is thinking with this, but maybe it'll be great. There is some question as to whether or not this hurts the brand. As The Hollywood Reporter put it in a succinct headline, is A24 still cool? There's a lot of pushback against AI from younger, creatively minded types, right? It's why you hear folks like Kane Parsons of A24's Backrooms rail against the technology, saying he would eliminate generative AI if he could. It's why you still hear folks bitching about Late Night with the Devil, making interstitial art for a show within a show with generative AI. There's a lot of angst out there about AI. People don't like AI. Polling badly. People don't want data centers. I don't know. It seems bad. Peter, will A24's infusion of AI blood money ruin its street cred with the youngs?
Well, I don't understand why people are upset about this. Honestly, like, this just strikes me as crazy. This is the world we're going to live in. Also, like, I mean, like, tech, AI, all of the tools that are available to filmmakers and to producers, to companies, to make the production process smoother, faster, more robust, those tools are going to be used. And there's just no way. That those tools are not going to be used. Now, what might happen is some filmmakers, maybe even some studios or kind of a loose coalition of aesthetically minded, artistically minded people might all decide and declare together, we're not going to use those tools. And that's, I think that something like that could happen. But if those people want to choose to not use those tools, other people are going to. And this just strikes me as, to be upset about this in particular, strikes me as not living in reality. because the tools exist, they are useful, and so filmmakers are going to use them. And that has always been the case with new technology and film. I mean, I was thinking about Steven Spielberg recently, and I have actually no idea what his position is on AI, so I'm not imputing he thinks this about AI. That's not what I'm saying. But I was thinking about Steven Spielberg, and if you watch The Fabelmans, which is his sort of self, right, like it's as close to a kind of autobiography as I think we're ever going to get from him. So much of that movie is about how he views himself as having essentially two brains, right? Two sort of mindsets that have come, that work together. The kind of free-flowing, natural artists, musicians mindset from his mother, and then the scientific technician, like tool use mindset from his father. And Steven Spielberg is, we've talked about this on the pod recently, maybe the single most natural filmmaker ever. Like he just has film brain deeply embedded to the point where now all of the rest of us think of film in his terms. Like it's hard to think of film outside of the Spielbergian influence, certainly from the last 40 years or so. And he really, like in that movie, and I mean, I think sort of in the way he talks about filmmaking, understands it as, yes, there's absolutely this intuitive, beautiful, artistic side, but it is also deeply and fundamentally a technical art. And technical arts are going to be about tool use and tool maximization. And this is a tool. And what you see here is it's a tool that they're going to use. That's not going to not happen.
Alyssa, is Peter right? Are the children wrong? Is it, is it just a function of cool kids on Twitter saying things that don't really reflect reality? Or is there a kind of a burgeoning backlash here?
So I want to disaggregate a couple of things. The first is that the political landscape around AI is very uncertain. The folks at The Argument, who have done a lot of really interesting polling, have found that there is sort of widespread unease around AI, but that it hasn't necessarily coalesced into a coherent platform about either how it should be regulated, how data centers should be built, or even sort of how people should be using it. Second, obviously, a lot of young people are using AI, right? You've seen this crop up as a sort of a widespread problem in academic settings. It's something that everybody's kind of figuring out on the fly. And so I think that there are definitely people who have a distaste around using AI for generative purposes. I actually count myself as one of them, even though I'm starting to use AI a lot more in my work. But I also think it's a problem for AI in particular that the generative stuff, right? Like the release of ChatGPT and image generators like Midjourney were what signaled, they were the releases that signaled to people that a new horizon, that a new technology was burgeoning, that we were maybe on the horizon of something very new. But those aren't necessarily the things that AI is best for in a business scenario, right? And so, I just want to name kind of three examples of the way that I've used AI in my own work that could be useful to filmmakers in the management of the filmmaking process. The first is in sort of color coding and scraping hex keys, right? I'm working in a nonprofit now. I wanted to make sure that the colors I was using in Google Forms matched the colors that we're using on our website. And, I could go bug our design director, or I could just take a screenshot, give it to Gemini and say, can you match all of the hex codes for me? Now I have that in a document. And so whenever I want to build a Google form, I can just create custom colors there. If you're a filmmaker and you want to, sort of check the colors of different things, like great tool, wonderful to sort of be able to run stills through and match things. Second, it's great for spitting out sort of budgets and financial modeling. And so, if you are a earlier career filmmaker who is able to sort of describe in plain language sort of what you've priced out so far, but maybe you don't feel that confident with spreadsheets and you want to be able to see what would happen if you adjust different factors, to your overall budget. The ability to describe that in plain language and have a chatbot write the formulas for you in Excel, I think can make people, just much more aware of what their projects are going to cost, how changing those factors will affect their work. And that's a great thing to be able to take to a studio executive if you are a young creative who maybe doesn't feel that financially or technically confident about things. And finally, you can use it to look for things that don't match, right? Sort of for pattern recognition, because what large language models are essentially really good sort of pattern matching tools. And so, for example, I'm rewriting part of our curriculum at the nonprofit where I work. And I sort of fed a spreadsheet with the classes into both Claude, where we have a Teams account, so they can't use our stuff for training, Gemini, same deal. And, you know, I had talked and asked these tools to compare the curriculum, this part of the curriculum from multiple years, and to identify anything that wasn't there anymore, or, you know, to sort of tell me what the differences were. And I'd done this with humans first, but the you know, Claude in particular noticed a whole sort of thread that I'd taken out of the curriculum that the humans had, who had taught this curriculum and been a part of it before, hadn't actually noticed was gone. And so, you know, if you are looking for continuity errors in your movie, for example, like, these are areas where using a pattern matching tool for that sort of thing could be really interesting. And look, I think people will have different feelings and objections about using AI in these ways, right? And they will want various levels of protection to make sure that their content, their insights aren't being used as training data. But I think it is sort of an unfortunate thing for the world of film where costs have ballooned, where, you know, movies are getting made for budgets that are not really sustainable given what the movies are, that the rise of AI on a tide of generative images might prevent people from using AI for management tools that are in fact really useful for curbing budgets, for making different kinds of projects viable, and for just making the process of filmmaking easier.
So you're saying it's you know, there's a legitimate use for AI in your view, not so much for you're talking about generative, but let's just call it creative work, right? Like this actually seems like a perfectly reasonable line to me to take aesthetically. I wouldn't say as a policy matter.
I don't want my students replacing their writing with generative AI, because I think the writing is actually a process where people do a lot of thinking and sort of arrive at their ideas. And I think it's bad to outsource that process. I don't want them doing first-stage research. But there are also situations where, like, I think Late Night with the Devil is a perfect example. Like, if you want something that feels sort of uncanny or inhuman, I think there can be completely legitimate artistic uses of AI. I do think it's good to sort of be clear in your crediting process and your sort of, like, I think it's good to be transparent about when you're using a new technology. And to have a clearly articulated reason for why you're using it if you're going to use it. I'm not that interested in, like, a movie that Claude would write, except in the sense that it would be sort of a distillation of what all the movie scripts that Claude has read, right? Like, I'm interested in sort of generative AI in terms of what it can tell us about sort of, you know, the corpus of human creativity. But I agree with young filmmakers who don't want to outsource their thinking and making and creativity to AI, because that's the fun part. So use AI for the boring management shit and get to spend more time being human. It's the best use case.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think the storyboard thing here is both the like best and worst case use in both of these senses. And what I mean is, on the one hand, people think of storyboarding as like, oh, it's this boring thing we have to do at the start of the movie, and like, I may not be able to draw very well anyway. I would have to hire somebody to do that, you know, blah blah blah. That's fine. But the problem is that is learning how to either do storyboard yourself or direct somebody to make storyboards that you want and to make the film look like you want is part of the creative process in and of itself, is part of the creation, is part of trying to determine your own, how your view of the film or film in general works. And I think that, like, look, when you're talking about somebody like Martin Scorsese, who, you know, has pretty good idea of what his visual sense is, and frankly, whose work probably informs a lot of these models, because his work has probably been stolen by them in the giant hoovering of data. That's not really a problem. It's with younger filmmakers who maybe don't have as good a sense of what they think their style is or should be, who don't know how to sit down and actually storyboard out a sequence to make it make sense, that are going to ultimately be hurt by this. And, you know, we can say, well, oh, poor them. They're saving time and, you know, money. But like, I don't know, man. I think that part of the creative process actually matters a lot.
So, can I just ask you both a quick question? Sunny, I know you don't like using AI personally, so I assume you haven't done much with image generation or anything at all. Is that correct?
I think I made one image once as a joke. Yes.
Totally.
But no, I don't use it at all. I don't have any of the AI apps. I don't have accounts with Claude or ChatGPT.
And Peter, have you done much in the way of image generation?
Probably not as much as many filmmakers, but yeah, I've done things like attempt to build a set of character models and then create panels for a comic book that I've had in my head for years, and I'm just not nearly a good enough artist, and I can kind of sketch out the basics, but they don't look right. I'll tell you, in my experience, the AI-generated images are kind of interesting in some cases, and also just not very good. It's a lot like writing, you know, where I find it an incredibly useful tool for aiding in writing. It's a lot like having an assistant that is extremely responsive, but it's also not very good at doing the writing itself.
Right. And what I was going to say to Sunny, and again, Sunny, I totally respect where you stand on all of this. I will say I have found that with image generation, it requires really exceptional written description to get anything even close to what you want. And so I do think that I feel like I'm somewhat less concerned about storyboarding sort of taking over for people's visual imaginations, because I think the tools are still weak enough in some way to require exceptionally strong sort of clarity of vision and ability to put that into literal text to produce anything usable. And so I can see a scenario in which it actually sort of forces people to sharpen their visions. But that's if someone has, you know, ambition and like a clear sense of what they want that's sort of in their head that they need to translate. So I think it would really depend on the person. But it is, yeah, I mean, as someone who like uses image generation sort of with my kids for various projects, it is, or even to just like design stencils for block prints I'm going to do, it's like, it takes quite a lot of work to produce sort of even one thing that I feel moderately happy with and that I'm not going to sort of alter by hand if I'm going to make it manifest in the physical world.
Can I ask you sort of a question here, but also kind of extrapolate a little bit on what you're talking about? Because it seems like there's sort of two ways that the storyboarding part of this could go. And one is, I just think about, if I understand correctly, Mad Max Fury Road did not start as a script. It started essentially as a storyboard. There's some words, but like it was a storyboard first. And you can kind of see that in the finished product, right? And that is just a total feat of visual imagination in which the layout of the cars is the movie, right? And so if what you want from your LLM is to storyboard a Mad Max, right? Like in that style, like to some degree or another, picking the shots. If we think of the director as the author of the movie and not the screenwriter, which is at least how the guilds have decided this for decades, if we think of that as being true, then storyboarding the movie is authoring the movie. And I think, you know, I can see that going wrong if you just sort of lazily let it do its thing in the way that I think we see in some cases, certainly on like Twitter, there are accounts that are writing stuff that's getting a lot of traction, but it's clearly all AI written prose. And you can imagine a version of film coming out of that is just as kind of irksome as the all AI written prose accounts. But also imagine a version of it that does quite well, because we see these accounts that are doing quite well with all AI written prose. On the other hand, I also think about what we were just talking about, you know, with the comic book stuff and with, you know, you talking about the necessity, the value of really good prompting. And Jesse Singel, who is someone I think many of us know, has been tweeting about how good AI is as an editor if you know how to prompt it properly, right? And how good it is at making suggestions, but you have to be really like clear-minded about your descriptions. And you can imagine a world in which there is, for example, someone, I don't want to say exactly like me, but like kind of like me, who can like draw out the proportions of the shot. I've got the thing in my mind, but it's really hard for me to get like a detailed, like deep, like nicely drawn image. And for AI to just sort of be a translation, and it might, you know, you can imagine a world in which AI allows those types of people to translate a vision that is entirely theirs, but they would have had to hire an artist. That's actually the thing I want to ask you about, Alyssa, because with Late Night with the Devil in particular, and I do think with a lot of the opposition, maybe not with this specific deal, but a lot of the opposition to AI in Hollywood and in other creative fields, but especially in Hollywood, is it takes jobs, right? Like, if you're not hiring an artist, you're not hiring an artist. And on the one hand, that makes things a lot cheaper, and it means that there are probably more productions that can be made. And I think that that's probably good. And on the other hand, that means you're not hiring an artist.
Yeah. And I struggle with that. I don't have the answer to that. I don't have the answer to that. I think it's hard. I think the question is,
You're not hiring the artist, and you're also not actually creating anything. Like, I'm sorry. I just dismiss all of this. I don't care. I don't care if you have prompted something very, very nicely. It's not your work. It's an amalgamation of everything that they, again, have kind of scraped off and thrown together. So I don't care.
I'm not just talking about descriptive prompts. I mean, AI can do things like take a bad sketch and just render it with a little more detail. It's fundamentally
your
idea
for
how the image is.
Right. I understand what you're talking about. You give it a thing and then it actually does it. And that's doing the work. And I don't care if a computer does your work for you. That's not interesting to me. That's boring.
That's totally fine as a matter of taste. I just think other people are going to reach different conclusions about it. And again, I think the real substantial gains in terms of efficiency and productivity are not going to be in creative spaces. They're going to be in managerial ones.
I also just think of a director who I'm not going to say because I think this person might actually be quite against AI, but who was just talking posting on a social media site within the last couple of months about how fundamentally the thing about being a director is simply being able to describe what is in your head and what needs to be done to get that thing to another person. And it seems to me that that is a skill that is transferable to AI and to LLMs as they exist now, that the skill in being a director is having it in your head and then being able to, mostly through words, describe the thing. And so that it comes out as a real picture instead of images that somebody else has made for you.
Right. You didn't do it yourself. Tarantino has talked about this, right? He says, like, I didn't necessarily know precisely what camera lenses I would want for this shot, but I would go to Richardson or whoever was shooting one of his films, and I would say, I want it to look like this, and then they would make it happen. I do not consider that to be the same thing as AI prompting, because you have humans doing things and making creative choices instead of, again, a machine somewhere spitting out stuff. I just don't care. I'm just an old man yelling at clouds. I'm out of touch here. But I do kind of wonder if there is enough of a burgeoning anti AI movement that is at least partly tied up to all of the Sam Altman type saying AI is going to take away all the jobs, and also it's going to replace intelligence, and you that will no longer be an innate talent. It will be something that is metered out that you can pay for. Like, that seems bizarre and weird. But you know, I maybe people won't actually be freaked out about that, and they'll embrace it. I could very well be wrong.
Or it could be a range, right? I mean, people have always had, you know, there are people who don't like modern art or atonal music or are perfectly happy to drink canned cocktails as opposed to the miracles that Peter, you know, dishes out in his home bar. And there may be just a range of these preferences in art, right? I mean, people have noticed that AI
there's always been a range of preferences in art. Part of the critic's job is to say, actually, this is shit. Speaking of, we're getting to some shit human creation here in a minute, but the
yeah we are it's just one final thing here. I recently watched an interview with Trent Reznor, the sort of mastermind behind Nine Inch Nails, and he talked about how when he was just starting out, his first album came out in 1989, Pretty Hate Machine, and he used drum machines, electronic drums, and he is known for kind of blending metal with danceable synths, but he talked about how in that era there was this like musical professionals looked down on anyone who used drum machines because they thought it was kind of cheating, because it meant, oh, you can't even play the drums yourself, right? If you're going to use a drum, programmed synthetic drums. And he was like, no, it's not that I can't play the drums. I can. But guess what? This plays drums in a way that is different and has a different textural quality. And that is specifically what I want. And he figured out, he was at the forefront, I think, the bleeding edge of people who figured out how to make something beautiful out of something that was seen as a cheap synthetic backwater. And I do think that that is possible basically with any technology. We've seen that story play out with tech in art time and time again. And why wouldn't it be the case in AI?
I look forward to fighting with you guys about this for many more years to come.
Forever.
So what do we think? Is A24 integrating AI into its workflow a controversy or a non-troversy? Peter?
It shouldn't be a controversy, but clearly it is. People are going to be upset by this.
Alyssa?
I think that, yeah, I think Peter's correct. I find it to be a non-troversy, but people will feel like it's controversial.
It's a controversy because the demon AI should be defeated on all fronts. So that's it's bad. All right. Make sure to swing by Thursday for our bonus episode on one of the great works of Western literature. No, not the Odyssey, though our book club is nearing the end. We're reaching the conclusion of the Odyssey. It's going to be very exciting. Lots of bloodshed to come. I speak, of course, of Independence Day, the 1996 film from Dean Devlin and Roland Emmerich. Aliens. Nonsense. Alien nonsense. This movie has it all. Five-star, stone-cold classic we are going to discuss. I'm very excited for that. And now on to the main event, Supergirl, from director Craig Gillespie, who is best known for the pretty good I, Tonya, and the pretty terrible Cruella, comes the adventures of Kara Zor-El, who's played by Millie Alcock. Kara is the cousin of Kal-El, a.k.a. Clark Kent, who's played by David Cornsweet in a few short scenes here. She's a bit of a mess in this movie, Kara is. She's depressed because she's the last surviving daughter of the Kryptonian city Argos. She's drunk. She's traveling the galaxy to planets with red suns so she can get her buzz on. Her only friend is a dog named Crypto. On
Relatable.
One leg of the what?
Relatable.
Yeah.
She's going around on drinking too much and hanging out with your dogs.
It's no way to live. On one leg of her intergalactic bar crawl celebrating her 23rd birthday, she comes across a young girl whose family has been killed by a race of outlaws called the Brigands. When these Brigands poison her dog, she vows to track them down and get the antidote, and also, I guess, get some justice for Ruthie, who's played by Eve Ridley. Turns out the Brigands are also intergalactic sex traffickers. They kidnap little girls from around the universe so they can impregnate them to propagate their male-only species. I just have a lot of questions about the biology of the... I don't understand a single thing that I just said, but it is the text of the film. I just needed to pass it on. Anyway, I guess what I'm saying here is that this is like a relatively hard tonal shift from Superman's kind of aw shucks, decency is good tone to this intergalactic romp about child trafficking. The one real bright spot is Jason Momoa's Lobo, who feels like he's in a different movie altogether. He plays the immortal intergalactic bounty hunter, kind of like Aquaman crossed with Beetlejuice, which is just a weird, interesting way to do it. I loved it. I thought he was great. But, you know, kind of wasted in this film. setting aside the weirdly dour plot is a not feel good film in the summer. Another problem with this movie is just that it looks like complete garbage all the time. Like, it has that kind of green room view from nowhere vibe that The Flash had, right? Where it's got these big battles and they're taking place in 360 degrees of action. And it's just throwing us 360 degrees of animated crap. It's all tinged in this weird brownish gray. There's no like real sense of motion or flow. It's boring and ugly. And audiences have clearly rejected it, given the B-minus cinema score, which puts it somewhere between The Eternals, which got a B, and Morbius and Madame Web, which both got C-pluses on the cinema score comic book rankings. For a while, Alyssa, it felt like on this show, we were doing a comic book movie like every 4 or 5 weeks. Like, people were complaining about it. They were like, you got to stop doing all these comic book movies. And we're just like, that's what people are watching. That's what's out there. And this is the first one we've done in 11 months. First one we've done in 11 months. Wild. We'll do, I assume, the new Spider-Man movie and at the end of July. That's probably going to do huge business because it's a Spider-Man movie. Spider-Man continued to be very bankable in the comic book cinematic landscape. But this is this movie is bombing. It's $38 million opening on a $170 million budget. I do wonder if this does signal, Alyssa, kind of the if people keep making movies after this, if people keep making superhero movies after this, there are going to start to be real questions from the boards of these companies. Like, what are we fucking doing here?
Yeah. Yeah, I realized at a certain point that I had just started to become resentful of the superhero industrial complex. And I think it was after Avengers Endgame when, in order to follow anything, I had to start watching a million TV shows, none of which were very good. And I just felt kind of screwed around, right? It's like the stuff that was, the quality fell off dramatically in terms of the scripts, the visuals. I mean, the performances, I think, have continued to be fine, but not interesting or outstanding in any way. And I just felt like there was a combination of being asked to do an enormous amount of work to sort of stay invested and to find the stuff that was coming out comprehensible, and just like a kind of contempt for the viewer as someone who demanded any level of sort of quality or thought or just, I don't know, curiosity or vision. And, you know, part of what I liked so much about Superman was both that it felt like a rebuke of that laziness, right? Like, it looked fun, it looked distinctive, it had, you know, I thought David Corenswet and Rachel Brosnahan were really good as, you know, as Lois Lane and Superman. There was some dumb stuff about journalism that is inherently going to bother me because I'm a journalist, but, you know, I've learned to live with that. But it also felt like a movie that was just tonally very different, right? It was a movie that you could take it a, you know, not a tiny kid, but it was a movie you could take a kid to in terms of tone, content, sort of level of intensity. It looked bright and clear and crisp for the most part. It was fun, right? And it felt eager to earn my approval by giving me a good time. And this just feels like sort of catastrophic backsliding, right? It's, you know, it's ugly. It's grim. It, you know, it tries to earn a sense that it's significant with a plot that is dark and deeply unpleasant, but not in any way that's sort of thoughtful or illuminating. I thought it was a real misfire, and spoiler alert here, to have Supergirl be comfortable just like killing people. I found that really sort of jarring and unpleasant. It just was not fun. And I think it's going to be a good thing if audiences sort of liberate themselves from this junk, right? I think all of us have felt like this has been kind of an exciting year in movie going because there's some stuff that is genuinely fresh and creative that's kind of tearing it up at the box office. But also audiences just seem really done with a model of the business and a kind of storytelling that has taken their dollars for granted for a long time now. And, you know, I think it is easy to get pessimistic about the movies and about movie-going audiences. But this actually, despite the fact that this is just a really terrible, and like not just terrible, but unpleasant, like really, really deeply unpleasant movie, it's good that audiences are rejecting it. Sometimes capitalism works. You know, and I think it's going to be a real problem for some of these studios that have made just sort of big financial bets on these franchises and are really counting on huge performance by very expensive movies to sort of make the rest of their slates viable. And so if superhero movies fail, we're going to be in for some turbulence in the movie making environment. But that kind of seems like a good thing.
So I don't think any of us like this movie, but how does it rank on the Madame Web scale?
As a person who has not seen Madame Web, I continue to think that, I continue to think that Across the Movie Aisle needs like a Madame Web to Oppenheimer scale, and then like a, you know, Alyssa is totally comfortable with the level of violence to a, like, Alyssa would run screaming from the theater because of the level of violence scale, sort of like the New York Magazine approval matrix. Maybe I'll actually draw this up and we can try and rate
Well, don't use
like
AI.
I won't use AI.
It's The Dark Knight. It's not Oppenheimer. Remember, the Dark Knight to Madame Web.
I will do it. Is it okay if I do it on data? Is it okay if I do it on Data Wrapper if I don't use AI?
I don't know what that means. The issue with this movie, Alyssa, one thing you touched on, which I think is very important, is it is striving to feel like an important film, like it has a thing to say, right? And like I think it's very weird if you look at several films that are coming out this year. You've got The Furious, which came out earlier this month, which is this Hong Kong martial arts action film about child trafficking. You've got this movie, which again about child trafficking. You got this Jason Statham movie where he's on a shipping container and he's stopping child trafficking or human trafficking, coming out in August or October or whatever.
And his last movie was about child trafficking.
Yeah, the one with the big moon, right? That was about child trafficking.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the only way I can remember that movie.
Literally the only thing I remember. Movie. The only thing I remember about that movie is that there's one shot with a giant moon in the background.
And it's not The Beekeeper.
It's an entire set piece.
It's wild. Anyway, but my point is, like, it really feels almost like somebody in Hollywood was like, you know what made Sound of Freedom work? Child trafficking. We're going to put child trafficking.
That's an interesting thought. Is a
great villain. Nobody likes child traffickers. Everybody hates them. You can do whatever you want to them. And this is one of the things that I came away from The Furious with is like, there's a fight scene in the movie. And a guy gets like put in a freezer and he's frozen and he comes out in an ice block and he's still kind of alive. I think his eyes are moving around and somebody like karate chops his head and the top part of the ice block goes shooting off. And you're just like, this is awesome to do to him. It's awesome to murder him in this way because he's a child trafficker. And it really does feel like that is the moral weight of this movie is like, you could do anything you want to these brigands because they are intergalactic child traffickers and it's good. It's good to kill them.
Yeah. But who looks at Supergirl and thinks what I want from this character is ultraviolence, right? Like, or the ability to murder people, right? Like, I think that there is sort of a confusion of political messages and moral messages in this movie in a sort of strange way, right? Because like part of what is very charming about Superman is like, turns out his parents are like awful people who want him to conquer the Earthlings. He's like, no, I'm going to decide to be a good person. And like a movie for kids, it's perfectly fine to have the message of the movie be not like, intergalactic colonialism is bad, but like, you can make your own decision about what kind of person you want to be and what kind of life you want to live, right? And like, you know, a movie like Supergirl, I think, could have worked. That's like, sometimes you're going to feel really sad and sometimes that may threaten to swallow you up, but it's good to be alive and be engaged with people and, you know, not just live down in the muck forever, right? Like, that's a useful message for kids to hear. I don't go to a Supergirl movie about like her and her dog to watch her like, you know, slit someone's throat. I'm just, it's just a fundamental misapprehension of sort of the character, but also like how a movie can be important or have a message. It's just bizarre.
I'll just say, I mean, I didn't really have a problem with her killing that guy because he deserved to die because he's a child trafficker. So I like the Sound of Freedom thing worked on me. But the Peter, one of the funny things about this movie is that there is this. So David Krumholtz plays her father in the we get these Argos flashbacks, right? And he's talking about his brother, who is played again. He's played by Bradley Cooper in the Superman movie. And one of the big reveals in that movie is that Jor-El actually wanted Superman to be space Genghis Khan, basically have giant harems of like human women to spread his seed through the, you know, repropagate the Kryptonian. And there's this
weirdest thing about the Superman movie.
There's this very funny but understated and like not really example. It's just like a little hint. But there's this thing where like Krumholtz's father character in this movie is like kind of like that wacky Jor-El is up to his nonsense with the space Hitler stuff. I just want you to go there and be happy and be good. All right. Just be good. Be a good person. Which anyway. Neither here nor there. What did you make of
Supergirl?
She still
feels lost and abandoned because even though James Gunn didn't direct this film, every single James Gunn movie has to be about a hero with like really serious parental trauma issues.
Can I also just say it would be very funny to watch a movie about David Krumholtz and Bradley Cooper as superpowered brothers?
I was pitching this on Letterboxd. They should have like there should be a prequel movie or series where Bradley Cooper and David Krumholtz are like making their plans to get off of Krypton, and like David Krumholtz is just trying to be like save everybody, and Jor-El is like gonna do space Hitler. It's gonna be great. We're gonna have Kryptonians everywhere. They're gonna be ruling everyone.
Yes,
Bradley Cooper would actually be pretty great.
Living room for the Kryptonians.
Anyway, Peter, what did you make of Supergirl?
Just profoundly misconceived at every level, to the point where it's baffling. I've spent more time than I should have over the past several days just trying to think about how this movie got through the pitch process, especially after Superman last year, which, as Alyssa said, was just clearly a rebuke to the darkness, grimness of the Snyderverse, with this sort of this idea that everything, these superheroes, especially that Superman himself. Yes, I know. I actually liked Man of Steel 2, Sonny, but like, that is not the classic portrayal of Superman. Superman is a bright, sunny, uplifting character. That's what they gave us, finally.
Superman executed Zod in the 1980s. That is not a new thing. It happens all the time. Anyway.
But even still, there's a kind of moral weight of sadness, and that movie is charming in a way that Man of Steel... Again, I like Man of Steel. I didn't like the rest of the Snyderverse, but... Last year, Superman was like, we're not going to do that anymore. And then boy, howdy, does Supergirl do exactly that in the worst possible way. And I just couldn't figure out how it passed muster with the, like, who was greenlighting this and why. The only thing I could come up with is we want to avoid, like the line of thinking had to be something like this. We want to avoid the Mary Sue problem, where female heroes are just super confident and have all of their shit together and like no problems and like everything's just sort of perfect. And like they just like it's everything comes easily to them. And like it's a bunch of quips, right? Like, you know, telling the patriarchy how bad they are. So we're going to make a movie about a Supergirl who has problems. We're going to start with her being kind of sad. She's got a drinking problem, right? Like, and then from there, and then you need some, then we're going to make, you know, we're going to make a feminist action hero story, right? That has some weight to it. And what's the very best feminist action movie ever made, right? You could argue it's Fury Road, and then maybe to a lesser extent, Furiosa. And so we are going to model our movie on Fury Road, and then to a lesser extent on Furiosa. And this movie just explicitly borrows in so many ways from Mad Max Fury Road. You've got the wives who are literally, what are they called? They're called the brides in this movie.
Brides.
You've got this intergalactic, you know, it's the sex trafficking gang, but it's they are a biker gang in the Mad Max post-apocalyptic style, down to their kind of leather and studs and all of this. I mean, this movie just lifts so aggressively from Mad Max.
Yeah, there's literally like an Immortan Joe style, like skull mask. That, you know, sort of suctions off at some point. It's
And so the only thing I could think of was they wanted to make a movie that avoided this Mary Sue problem, that gave her a kind of agency, and that was like a kick-ass feminist action movie. And so they were like, what's the best one ever made? Let's make Supergirl a version of that. And you can understand, I think, how you could get there conceptually. And also, that's a crazy, crazy idea for a Supergirl movie, to make it a borderline, I mean, in this case, it's a PG-13, but to model it after an exceptionally grim and violent, hard R, like a post-apocalyptic chase movie, that is the wrong model for your Supergirl film. Supergirl, even more than Superman, needs a kind of light touch. This franchise needs a light touch. And as it happened, the night after I saw this, I couldn't sleep. And so I did what I often do when I couldn't sleep. I watched old Superman, the animated series, the Paul, the Deanie Tim era, right? These same guys who made Batman, the animated series, and the Justice League show that ran on Cartoon Network. In between, in the late 90s, they made Superman, the animated series. And I think this has been somewhat underrated as people look back at, oh, Batman's the really great one. Superman, the animated series is maybe the single best portrayal of Superman, but also it has an incredible portrayal of Kara, of Supergirl, who is spunky, difficult, bright, like she is a teenage girl who wants out of her Kansas life. Like, she has all of the things that you would want from a movie about, okay, we're not just going to make this, you know, she's not going to be Rey from Star Wars and just sort of have all of her problems solved and be perfectly poised and not actually all that interesting a character. She has conflict with her parents, with Superman himself. She has like naivete about the world because she's young, because she's from another planet. It's such a wonderful portrayal, but it's also perfectly, like, you could show this to a six-year-old easily, as long as they weren't super, super, super sensitive. She can exist in the kind of cosmic DC realm that James Gunn clearly likes to explore, the kind of heavy metal-inspired, weird, you know, weird cosmic space stuff, right? There's an episode in which she's, like, fighting off Granny Goodness and Darkseid, and it's great, right? Those characters work well, like, together, and they figured out how to do this 25 years ago, and it's just crazy to me that this was the pitch that they went with. And then, frankly, Craig Gillespie, people like Itania, but Cruella is the kind of the movie that this is most like, yeah, in a lot of ways. It's a movie about it's a big budget franchise film, in some sense, an IP film anyway, about a female anti-hero. And both of these films have actually quite good central performances, and they are bad, ugly-looking movies.
Yeah.
It really is. It is a shockingly ugly film. I'm sorry, Alyssa. Just one thing. And I was shocked that this was shot by Alex Garland, cinematographer. It's the guy who's made like the last four Alex Garland movies. Shot Civil War. Civil War is a movie you watch and you're like, oh, I can understand the action here. This all makes sense to me. I can see it all. It's very well done. When I looked up the cinematographer, I assumed it was the guy who shot The Flash, because it looks that ugly. And like, I was genuinely shocked when I saw who it was.
Yeah, I was particularly bummed about this because I like Millie Alcock a lot. I think she's the best thing in this. I think she was the best thing in the first season of House of the Dragon. Frankly, like, the only thing that kept me watching that, because I hated it. You know, I like that she is the rare Hollywood actress who, like, hasn't had all her teeth fixed, right? Like, she's very winning. But, man, like, I want her to be in something that's, like, genuinely sunny. Like, put her in a rom-com, for God's sakes. Like, cast her in one of the seasons of Bridgerton. Like, she's just putting her on all this just, like, grimdark nonsense is making me incredibly depressed.
On the other hand, if you wanted to make a grimdark movie here, the thing to have done would have been not to make a Supergirl movie. There is lurking somewhere here in this movie a pretty good, funny, and fun Lobo film in which Supergirl sort of shows up, in which it's not, it's like, this is a movie about Supergirl where Lobo shows up three times or something like that. And every time Lobo is on screen, the movie, I won't say it's better, but it's more coherent. it makes more sense. Like, this is supposed to be a Lobo movie. And make this, frankly, make this just literally the plot of this movie, where Lobo's out there trying to kill a guy because he's a bad guy and he's getting paid for it, right? So we don't care that the guy's going to get killed, because first of all, the guy's bad. Second of all, Lobo is somebody you don't, he's supposed to kill people. But the thing about Lobo is he's heartless, right? He's got no sort of morals, right? Right. Like, and so he's not relatable. So you put Supergirl in as the sidekick in the second act, who shows up for a couple of kind of extended cameos, and you basically make act two, you know, Arya and the Hound from season four of Game of Thrones. And it's this gruff old, like, killer guy, and like the young woman character who is like bringing something to, right, but also has some personal stake in this, right? And is learning something her own way. Make this a Lobo movie. James Gunn, I think, wanted to make a Lobo movie and had to follow up with Supergirl.
If you literally just flip the characters and it's Lobo on a bender learning to feel again because some little girl's family gets killed, it's literally...
I like this movie already. This is now a good movie.
It's literally 100% better. It is so spectacularly misconceived that I don't understand what they were doing.
Mad Max Furiosa with Supergirl. Nope, I'm sorry. Go back to the writer's room for a week and just take a little bit of time. Think of another one.
Yeah.
Not good.
All right, so what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Supergirl? Peter.
God, this was awful. I don't think it's quite as bad as Madam Web, but maybe more unpleasant. Thumbs down.
There we go. Alyssa.
Thumbs down.
Definitely thumbs down. It's funny, I rewatched the original Supergirl, which is also terrible in its own, it has its own issues, but it somehow, it's actually worse than this still somehow. But I don't understand why they can't get this character right. It shouldn't be that hard. All right. That is it for today's show. Many thanks to our subscribers on Substack at movieisle.substack.com. Check out our merch at our Dashery store. Tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyMunch. I'll convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Thursday, hopefully.